Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2024, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial festivals and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Stephen Daisley grew up on New Zealand's North Island. His first novel, Traitor, won the 2011 Prime Minister's Literary Award for Fiction. Coming Rain won the Ockham Prize in 2015. And A Better Place was longlisted for the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize. Stephen is a generous talker, and it was a pleasure to welcome him to Imagining the Past.
Thank you.
I usually start my interviews. Your pathway to publication seemed long and quite varied. I just wonder if you could give us a bit of a summary of all of its twists and turns.
Probably it was like I wasn't published till I was something like 52, and I'd had this call, and it, for me, it was writing. It was a woman called Kiri Hume for The Bone People, 1975. She won the Booker Prize. She was a New Zealand writer. And then there was another woman, Emily Dickinson, of course, that great American poet, and quite a few of the others, and Walt Whitman, and then there was Henry Lawson. And the reaction that I used to have from reading these wonderful writers was quite remarkable. And that's when I felt that was the path that I wanted to follow. And as a result, I was pretty much a failure to everything else I tried. And so eventually, I was lucky enough to have a partner who allowed me to sort of pursue the dreams, and I did. And that's when I first met Gail Jones at Murdoch University, and she was a great mentor for some time. And it was about, and then of course the searching began. You know, people like Charlie Bukowski, who said, "Don't try to be a writer, be or you know, just be who you are, be complete." And these were resonances for me that meant so much. And then I was published, and lucky enough with my first book, and it did rather well. But
it's interesting you mentioned Walt Whitman. I was just reading one of his poems waiting for you to come online when I heard At the Close of Day. Such a beautiful poem.
Yeah, it is. He was wonderful.
Way ahead of his time, and so kind of frank and so honest and so secure in himself. Yes. Really,
1855. It was 100 years before I was even born. I think I read that song myself, and I start the next book with a quote from him. And in fact, it's, you know, he whoever degrades another degrades me. Which I think is pretty good, and so we'll go from there.
So you were 52 when Traitor was published?
Yes, yeah.
That kind of makes you the Annie Proulx of the Antipodes, doesn't it? Really?
You know of Annie Proulx, yeah. It was hilarious because I had a dear Irish friend, and in that lovely Irish way of inverting things, but I told him about Annie Proulx. I think she was 53 or something.
Yeah, I think it might have been mid 55, but I think she'd had some nonfiction things published. But yeah.
That's right. She'd been a journo, hadn't she? Anyway, this guy, Joe Brennan, wonderful fella. Both is Irish with a great sense of humor. He said, "Oh, well, you beat him by 3 years." Well, that wonderful aversion, you know. It was so terrific. You've
kind of touched on this a little bit, but just kind of what made you start to see yourself as a writer? When did that start to happen in your life?
It was probably when I began describing things in letters to my parents while I was overseas in the military when I was in 1920. But prior to that, I'd always had this wonderful affinity to things, you know, poetry, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you sort of kept that a little bit of that to yourself in the environment that I grew up, which is a very sort of masculine frontier almost type environment where, as I've said in several of my books now, it was to have the knowledge to, say, break in a horse or to put a fence up was much, much more valuable than somebody who could write or paint or even discuss philosophy, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember I was at a writer's festival in Adelaide and I was speaking about this very subject and somebody came up to me and said, she said, "Well, I'd rather have somebody that could catch a fish on a desert island rather than write a poem about it." And I said, "Well, surely we can do both. You know, can't we do both?" And so I guess that's where I come from.
So what were your first thoughts when you started planning A Better Place? How did that start to come together?
Well, again, I get up very early in the morning, and also I used to walk, and I just used to allow it, but I also have an exercise that I'd picked up somewhere along the line about just free writing. Possibly even Gail Jones may have spoken about this, but just don't edit. I just start off by writing and then allow the feelings to come. And all of those, as I say, Henry Lawson, et cetera, all of those sort of men that were writing about these things were never ever sort of spoken about as well. I just allowed my imagination to work really and just sort of went from there and followed that. And then a terrific editor with Mandy Brett, text, she manages to, she said, there's gold nuggets there, Stephen, but we have to find the connections. And that was the t-shirt that I also had, which was a comment by her, which was wildly unfashionable, that she described the manuscript, the last manuscript, as that was a better place. But
well, maybe you could just give us a little bit of a summary of the novel without giving spoilers away, or spoilers certainly that you don't want to give away anyway.
No, it's basically it's the story. It's a story that we heard because I'm the grandchild of so many people who were served and affected by the First World War, and I'm the child of so many people who were affected by the slump, as they called it, the Depression, and then the Second World War and the aftermath. And they were incredibly boring, of course, but they wanted things to be boring. And so as a result of that, we heard the many, many stories about the men usually and a few women who went overseas to serve, and then how they were affected and how they came back. And I really wanted to visit that and just about those years and how it was affected, and also to touch on some more relevant sort of subjects at the moment about, you know, some of the more political issues in New Zealand, which, you know, most people sort of probably didn't read. My wife said that there were too many guns in it, for example, and yes, and other people said there were not enough. So you never can tell, can you? But that's the outline. It's the story of two brothers that go away, twin brothers, wildly different personalities. One brother returns and he takes a much more sort of traditional role in the New Zealand sort of history of rural history of the pioneer type fellows that took the land that was given to them. And then he reconciles with his brother, who is, as I say, wildly different, incredibly creative, but, you know, he's, yeah, he loves his brother, and he, you know, and he, yeah, and he finds that his brother's gay, and has always been so, and then he has a lot of trouble sort of even accepting that, and it's just, there's a lot of sort of stuff that's probably not said as well, and it's hinted at, but a lot of people have written to me and said that, you know, how they have found it incredibly touching, so I have been touched as a result.
So you mentioned that you served in the New Zealand Army. How old were you when you were doing that, and what kind of did that involve? What was your experience?
I was just a baby. I was 19, you know.
It's a song, isn't it?
There is a song, but it didn't occur to me, thank goodness. But I was of that era, and when that song was, I was only 19, was certainly recorded, and a lot of my contemporaries had served in Vietnam, for example, and were sort of affected by even that trauma. And I say even, I don't mean to sort of play it down, but a lot of them sort of had issues, and they carried those issues through. But and there was also that terrible Agent Orange, which had, you know, deformed so many people, etc. And so there was all of that coming to terms. And for us, of course, of the whole military history was very important, you know, being in the military. And then I left, I think I was 21 or 22 when I left, or 23. And then I just sort of started my journey. Yeah, my journey. Yeah. I'm married, 5 children, etc. And yeah, all the different jobs. But I delivered papers at night so I could write. Yeah, all of that. Yeah, and I was told off. I never told my father, for example, that I wanted to be a writer. I told my mother, and she said, "Don't worry, darling, you'll grow out of it."
Sounds like something I was told. So I guess I'm always interested in what is so interesting about war for writers, because, for me, war kind of represents the best and the worst of humanity in a way. So I'm just kind of wondering why you're interested in it, and also what your experiences in the military actually brought to your writing, because, you know, the writing's got a very immediate and convincing feel to it.
Thank you. Yes, I have a great imagination, and I a lot of people have asked me about my war experiences, and which are nil, absolutely nil. But I do have an imagination, which, you know, I've been cursed with in some ways. But if I just sit and think for a while, I can sort of go to places, and I've always had that. Is it an ability? Is it a curse? I don't know. But as you answered the question yourself, Greg, I think, because it does bring out the best and the worst in people, and the war or whatever. But this seems to me much more of the worst than the good. But the heroics, I think, and the sacrifice is remarkable and worth thinking about. And I think we do sort of tend to forget about it and you know, think that it's okay, but it's just worth remembering, I guess. But it was something that I really needed to write about. But also that wonderful notion of twins and difference, and, you know, I always loved that quote by Jung that said, "What to any male child, what did you do with your twin sister at birth?" You know, and sort of getting in touch with our complete self, and, you know, and all those stories of love, how we used to be a creature of with 4 arms and 4 legs, and our hubris, I think it was, the gods separated us, and we spent the rest of our life looking for our other half. I forget the exact number. I think it was Plato or someone who wrote the story. And yeah, so that's, again, is that whole notion of becoming a complete person, and often seen through twinhood, especially in the early Greek myths, but, you know, old tropes, of course.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your selection of the twins as your main characters, because, I mean, it's very interesting. But like, you've kind of partially explained your process to selecting them, but, like, I mean, you chose fraternal twins rather than identical twins. They're both male, and they're quite different. So how did you kind of come to these characters? What was your kind of process to that?
Again, a lot of thinking, Greg, and a lot of just sort of meditating on these things and then allowing the process. For me, I allow the process to come. My poor, long-suffering wife probably thinks I'm a little touched, but I'll just sort of sit away by myself and think for a long time, and they come. And they, I forget who it was some famous writer said, they will come and they will roll and do somersaults before you eventually. And that's what I have been cursed with in my life. I have this imagination which allows these guests and friends to come visit me and talk about who they are to me. There's probably something that you could ring a psychiatrist up about, I don't know. But I mean, for me, and I, luckily enough, was people like Gail Jones. I'm allowed to sort of try to express it and get on with it. And for some people, it really resonates, which is delightful. And for others, not so. You know, they are. Some people are repelled by the use of war as a metaphor for humanity, which is another thing that I do. I bring out the best and the worst. It is, you know, who was it said that I think it was William Blake, said all the heavens and hells dwell within us. And I think I used to have that as a screensaver at some stage, and then somebody changed it, something about, yeah, anyway. And I think that is just it. I'm just looking right here now. I have an Annie Proulx book and a book by Homer beside me, you know. So there we are. That's the Odyssey, you know, and that's that.
Yeah, the novel reminded me a lot of David Malouf's The Great World with, especially there's a scene in The Great World where, I forget the characters' names, but one of them carries the other one into a river he's got an ulcer on his leg, and he places him in the river and these small fish come into the wound and clean the wound out and save his leg. So it's an incredibly kind of intimate situation between these two men, and the sexual metaphor is, you know, absolutely alive and intentional. And their relationship is so close, but when they come back from the war, they can no longer relate to one another in normal society. They can only relate to one another through their wives. So I kind of felt your novel kind of went into this stuff of masculinity and what is it for males to be intimate in another way, you know, but you've done it between two brothers, between two twins.
Yeah, Malouf is highly influential to me as well. And I, in fact, my next book is the protagonist's first name is Ovid, of course, and that comes from an imaginary life. And he's just so good, isn't he, Malouf? He's just remarkable. And, you know, you can sort of just read him for forever. I think he's an important intellectual writer. I think we're lucky to have him.
But that, I think what I was kind of getting at was just that the men forced into this situation by war, I can imagine that very intimate relationships must have sprung up between them just out of necessity. And Malouf's example is, you know, they physically cared for one another, but they, you know, literally saw bits of one another men weren't meant to see. And so when they came back, they were kind of divorced from one another in a way. And I kind of feel like that's in your relationship between Tony and Roy, that there's this kind of intimacy, but they just kind of don't know how to act on it or what it means.
No, but it's that wonder. Yes, you're so insightful, Greg. Just that grace that you have with somebody that is a dear and close friend, that just being in their company, you don't need to even, you don't feel the necessity to talk or to be anything but who you are. And I think that's often shared between brothers, especially twin brothers who perhaps grow up and never forgetting they went through the trauma of a terribly traumatized father and a mother who left, and they held each other's hands, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that wonderful intimacy. And then, which of course is also referred to in the caring of the wounded, where, you know, and men with terrible dysentery would clean each other up, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, who would talk about that later, right? You know, wiping someone else's backside, et cetera, except perhaps hospital orderlies. And especially it was very, as you say, very intimate, and but also very dear.
It's something that's lost in a lot of male-to-male interaction in normal society.
Yes, and it was almost like that rejection of you know, like the ultimate crime when I was growing up, you know, was to be gay and you know, or to have that those feelings of intimacy or love. Or I can remember being teased unmercifully about these sorts of things by some of my old comrades about talking about the three forms of love and et cetera, like, you know, eros and agape and philos, or from the Greek model, and being told, what do you mean agape? But I think most people don't get far beyond the eros or the erotic stage of love, and not fully understanding the completeness of it. And I think that, again, there's so many references to Greek philosophy, etc., in there. And I mean, a lot of that comes from my teaching. I mean, Marianne Campbell, I remember she taught me as well. She's a great writer from here, and she wrote about Ariadne. You know, I think The Apprenticeship of Ariadne, I think, was a short story she wrote. And Ariadne in ancient myths was abandoned on the island of Naxos, and, you know, she'd helped Theseus, you know, find his way out of the labyrinth, etc. And as her reward, of course, she was abandoned, and she was held up as an example quite often, or as a metaphor for how so many successful men abandon their wives and move, you know, the successful and move on to their. But anyway, it was again that influence and that introduction to the whole of I suppose intellectual thought or exploration that I was lucky enough to be introduced to by Marianne and Gail and all the rest of it. And, you know, I was just a silly lost old fool who didn't even really know much at all. But they were very kind to me, very good to me.
Yeah, because your writing does seem very concerned with masculinity, but it's not in a masculinist manner, which I would kind of suggest someone like Flanagan is. I mean, you seem interrogative of it, whereas he kind of seems promoting or supportive of it. So, I mean, masculinity seems
well
to intrude.
Oh, my God. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, masculinity seems to intrigue you, whereas, I mean, I've come away from it feeling it's just a quagmire, whereas you seem to be kind of in there in the battle with it. And I'm just wondering what you feel about that.
Thank you. Again, I think so. Quite often, I was in the military, and you saw the different types of people and how those terribly, you know, hard, tough guys were also quite tender and quite loving and quite, you know, helpful and decent. I, for example, had a dear friend who couldn't read or write when he joined, and he covered it up well. And then a very senior NCO helped him all the way through. I don't know what you make of that, you know, but again, it's that duality of humanity, I guess. It's always intrigued me. You're these terribly, terribly harsh and brutal men, and yet they show the most intriguing sort of kindness and decency at the same time, which is it's quite stunning. And that sort of thing's always fascinated me. It's easy to dismiss it, but I just couldn't. And I was a little bit like a dog with a bone with much of this sort of stuff. I just sort of, don't use that dog metaphor again. I love animals, as you probably have gathered, but much more reliable than humans, from what I've found. I just think, well, the human condition, I mean, it's become a cliche, of course, but I mean, it does. And who was, I think it was Faulkner, because I love all of these people, said, there's only one thing worth writing about, and that's a conflict in the human heart, you know. And I think that's kind of beautiful as well. But well, I for example, have so many of my dear old military friends have always referred to me as the poofter. Because I have, you know, I've always been interested in the things. And as I learned very, very early, not to say anything too much, but that's how I was used to write.
Maybe we can go back to that in a minute, because I've got some kind of questions around that. But like, I think your depiction of war in the novel, like depictions of war in novels can often be a bit like Maria von Trapp taking children around Salzburg on a bike tour. And yours is kind of welcomingly frank and graphic. And again, to the point that I felt really involved in it, whereas in The Narrow Road to the Deep North, I think when I was in the camp in Burma, I really felt very unaffected by that. And I felt, what's wrong with me? Have I turned into some hard ass that I'm just not actually feeling any of this? But with yours, I really kind of felt it. So I'm just wondering, was that violence, you know, graphic violence, quite difficult to write? And were there limits? Did you feel a limit to what you could take it to?
No, again, I'm just trying to remember who it was. It might have been Rilke, but he said, if you just sit still long enough, things will come to you and they will perform for you. And when you get real honesty with Cormac McCarthy, for example, is a man who I think writes, well, he wrote incredibly honestly. I was Harrison, who's, you know, who wrote Delver, etc. Again, those types of writers, for me, just were really, really honest, and they were writing from somewhere that, oh, who's that wonderful short story writer, Chapman, I think his name was. Again, American, wonderful, wonderful writers. Walt Whitman, again, just how could you lie? I mean, well, yeah, I guess you could believe the stories or the war type novels and comics that have been put out. But I mean, to tell the truth, I think is you need to let, because I have a theory about the reader being the writer, so that you, when you read my work, you make sense of it and you feel it and you feel the honesty, or you feel, you know, or the contrivance, or the, you know, or the showing off, or whatever. But as the reader, you are the writer. And for that really works for me, because you can't bullshit. You can't bullshit the reader, you know, because they are the writer.
The character Manny I found really interesting, just because he reminded me of a lot of boys I went to school with, in that the character like Manny needed the overtly identified homosexual to refine himself against, in that he is so I'm not, you know. But he also reminded me of a quote from Quentin Crisp of some queers are tough, but some toughs are queer. Like he just really... So I thought you really encapsulated an incredibly complex character in him.
Great ones.
How did you kind of arrive at that?
Well, I've known a lot of men like that. A lot of men, that's where the Manny comes in. But there's people like the Cray twins, for example, these overtly aggressive boxers, et cetera, et cetera, you know, also had male lovers, which is, I think, is wonderful. But it really comes out. And, you know, I knew of so many men that were just like that in those showers. And, you know, we'd have these enormous showers where everyone showered together, and the Manny types were always looking at the other men, you know, and making comments.
Or commenting, yeah.
Yeah. And, but even within him, there was this wonderful tenderness. I mean, it comes that wonderful power of the dog, that movie that's been recently made. I think that also touches on that, and that aggressive chap.
Well, when Manny and David are throwing together in the the birthing of the child. I mean, it's Manny that becomes more maternal.
Yes. Well done.
Which well is done. Really, yes. Really lovely twist, I think.
I was debated about that so much, and it was very difficult. I wish I could have had someone like you to speak to about it, because that what you just said confirms so much about how I see this whole thing working. And a lot of people don't sort of see that, or don't understand that, or don't think about those type of things. They, you know, I really try not to write war porn or anything that is celebrating any of the horrors of our existence. But, you know, you also try to find within someone like Manny those redeeming features, and being told I love you is very difficult to get beyond, I think. And when he's told I love you, te amo, you know, then she died and he saved the baby, but, you know, and she was called Renata, I think, which means rebirth and all of that. But yeah, that you would have certainly expected David, who takes on the initial maternal role and of this sister, of, you know, cleaning the mucus out of the child's mouth, etc., and tying the knot and cutting the umbilical cord. But it's Manny who keeps that child alive and won't do what is probably convenient, which is just to stand on the child's head. I've heard these sorts of story from chaps I've worked with as well, because I used to work with a lot of ex-World War II guys who, and in the military there were some absolutely dreadful stories, ones that aren't really worth thinking about too much, but it brutalizes everyone, this bloody thing.
But I thought your naming of the men giving David the nickname of sister was a great kind of encapsulation of that whole acceptance but rejection, and also it's endearing but it's also deriding. And
thank you.
Yeah, I thought that really rang true for me of men, particularly the other stuff of, you know, masculine interaction, which is all about denial, you know, so, oh, you wouldn't have any good friends, would you? And, you know, there's this, and that's still really alive today. I witnessed that a couple of weeks ago, you know, in a situation that I had to actually walk away from because it was just annoying me so much that the interaction was just this kind of negative repartee, and you couldn't get beyond that. You know, that was all these men could do with one another.
And men are so indoctrinated into this from a very early age, from school, et cetera, et cetera. And we're always talking about toxic masculinity and the effects. But the toxic masculinity has been with us for years. I mean, I went to a boarding school. I was sent to a boarding school at a fairly young age. And in this boarding school, it was just as brutal. And that, you know, one of the initiation rites was the toothpasting and nuggeting of each other's anuses, you know, and testicles as well. And, you know, and I had this happen to me, and I participated in these things. And you don't even know how dreadful it is until you think, well, I certainly didn't, until you think about these things later on. It was all sort of, yeah, it was very brutal, but it was also that denial, and it was also those other things. I mean, I sort of just don't write about this things. You're probably going to have to edit some of that out, I know. But yeah, there was a lot of repressed homosexuality, for example, at school. I mean, and you know what, boarding school, I guess you don't know, a lot of people don't, but they were dreadful places. They used to beat us with canes, and we were terrified and mortified to behave ourselves and do exactly what the regime told us. And I guess then from there, of course, I went into shearing gangs and the military, so it took me a while to learn.
I've got a quick look around on Goodreads, because normally a male author writing about war will attract mainly male reviewers, but you seem to have attracted a fair number of female reviewers, which I kind of found interesting given that, you know, the novel is almost completely absent of female characters. What would you kind of attribute that interest to? Because, and given the demographic of who reads, you know, it's mainly women. So from a commercial perspective, you know, an author really does need to attract female readers. So I'm just kind of wondering what you kind of make of that.
Very insightful. Yes, I've been told that on several occasions that I don't. But why is, I think they were just attracted to the sensitivities. That's what certainly what my wife, she told me in no uncertain terms that it had too many guns and too much attention and too much masculinity. But the second part she really liked I think it what really, really resonates with so many of my wonderful female readers is that they see the sensitivity, they see the redemption, they see the path to redemption is through forgiveness, etc. And that, you know, that just resonates. It's like, for me, it's like a mother again kissing that newborn child sort of thing. Is that, and how, and I think women are sort of, as Jung said, what did you do with your twin sister at birth? What did we do with that side of ourselves at birth rather than becoming sort of so violently masculine that we just want to kill everything that we see? That our only hope for the whole planet, for ourselves and for humanity, is to forgive ourselves. I forget who it was. It was a wonderful philosopher that said, we're all one. And he said, when you're doing something like with a tool and you slip with your hand, and you skin your knuckles, you made a mistake, but you don't beat up your hand, you know? You say, oh, shit, I made a mistake, you know? But if we're all one, what we do now, if someone makes a mistake, we tend to condemn them or beat them up or hurt them or kill them or, you know, drop bombs on them like, unfortunately, those people are doing in America at the moment.
I heard something the other day that we're all related back then. It's, you know, fairly common sense, but we're all related back to that first piece of DNA or whatever it is that arrived on the planet and replicated. We're all related back to that first cell, which, you know, is a quite obvious thing, but quite mind-blowing when you think about it, that, you know, that it all started somewhere.
And how can we condemn ourselves? We must always forgive ourselves, because if we don't, we had it, really, you know, and that's what's so beautiful about all of those. And again, sister, but also you may or may not have noticed that the CSM of the company was called Mother. So again, it's that sort of, yeah, things put around there. But the sister thing is as well as getting back to what I said before about Jung saying, what did you do with your beautiful sister at birth? And I'm my older brother who's passed away, and my older sister, they were twins as well. So again, it's that reflection on all of those things that.
That's interesting. That's interesting. You have had those people in your lives, because after I'd finished reading the book, I was thinking, I wonder what it would have been like if the twins had been, you know, a brother and sister, because that's a kind of really odd combination, because they are just brother and sister. They just happen to be in the one womb kind of thing.
Right.
So it's a, yeah, I just kind of wondered what the novel would have been like if you had had that at the center rather than two males.
Well, again, I wanted the two males just to sort of explore the sort of love that, you know, that David had, which was, I think, is just so, is very beautiful. And then the brother love as well, and, you know, and the little bit of erotic love between the male and the female was at the beginning of the book, where he pays for a girl in Italy or a woman who's forced into that sort of lifestyle because she needs to feed her children. But I also dedicated the book to a chap by the name of Len Seaman, who was a chap my mum and dad had the pub in centre of the North Island where I grew up. And he had won the DCM, but he was a gay man. And he took my mum and I to watch Dr. Zhivago. And I looked over, and that wonderful song with the daffodils, and he was weeping. War heroes didn't weep. No, I was 10 or something, you know, and again, I'm thinking about that. Wonderful, wonderful man, Mr. Len Seaman.
Maybe just a few craft questions, because you've divided the novel into what are kind of chapters, but they're not really marked off as chapters. So the divisions kind of seem to denote changes of point of view, but these also kind of happen in middle of the chapters as well. You've got changes of point of view delineated with a line break. So I'm just kind of wondering what your strategy was about the dividing the novel up in that manner.
No particular strategy as such. I've never ever tried to sort of achieve anything along those sort of lines. I never like to try to manipulate my readers, who are the writers of the novel, into thinking certain things. A lot of that is instinctual for me. I mean, a lot of it is you're reading along and then you start to wonder what happened to the other there. And then I sort of go on to that. So there was no particular strategy. And I'm very lucky to have a wonderfully patient editor in Mandy Brett at Text who just helps guide me through these things. And I think by just going on and on and on about one particular person or subject, and rather than sort of popping in, like, for example, I was putting in the chapters of between Roy and Sister, etc., and David, and it just sort of all, for me, that's the way it just sort of unfolded. And then there was a longer piece, of course, you know, when Roy gets home and begins to settle, and then he has his reconciliation, but his brother is terrified of him until he begins to weep. And then all his terror, because he's finally being who he was. And a lot of those things in the book, you know, where they looked at that wonderful Greek statue of the wrestlers, for example, where he said, you know, they look like they just want to fuck each other or whatever it was. And Roy says, I've just about heard enough for one day, you know. But it's the most beautiful sculpture. It's in the Wanganui art gallery, I think. It was, from memory. And I never ever used to be able to I thought it was just so good. And I used to look at it all the time, and that's probably also why my friends sort of questioned me. But anyway.
So you've also got periods of time move around quite fluidly as well, which I think a lot of emerging writers think that's a very easy thing to do, but I think it's always a very complicated thing to do. So how did you kind of arrive at that? How did you do that to make them so fluid?
Probably a high influence of modernism and a lot of years of not being published, a lot of reading, a lot of thinking, and just saying, does this work for me? And all of the great writers that I enjoy, like Annie Proulx, I really love Annie Proulx, for example. I'm a great Cormac McCarthy fan as well, you know, and so many of those writers, but it sort of comes through. I don't like science fiction, but that's only me. Even though I do read it, but I just think there's enough here for us to be fascinated. Looking within, for me, it's just revealed so much. And again, it is listening to that voice and the wonderful, what are they? They're sort of like helpers that come doing somersaults before you, I think. And I'm trying to remember who that was. I think it was that one, it's one of the great early American writers on Malden Pond, I think it was the guy who wrote that, Theroux or something. Yeah. And if you just sit back and you wait, they will come. If you've got a clean heart, a Zen heart, if you like, and they'll come and roll and they'll talk to you. And again, getting those sort of time shifts is so difficult. And as you say, it can get really clunky. You think it's easy, but it's not.
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult thing to do, and you know, I admire your ability with it. So, one last question with kind of crafty stuff. I kind of understand that you're not so concerned about plot. That wasn't really your main intention, but
modernist
again. I just kind of thought. You know, the dramatic irony all the way through that we as a reader knew that Tony was alive and thriving in a way. Did that diffuse the ending, or was there a fear that that would just diffuse the ending, really, because, you know, when I got to the ending, I wasn't that surprised, I don't think.
Oh, no, very difficult, because I rewrote that probably 100 times, and trying to get that right was, I'm still not happy with it, to be honest. I still wanted it to be slightly more, you know, there was something more about that. And I wanted, I'd written earlier, but a lot of it had been cut, you know, I'd written a lot more about it. And it was Roy coming to terms with his brother, his twin, his beloved twin brother's sort of coming out. It was, wasn't handled as I would have liked it. I have, you know, I have a wonderful cousin who was on the land, and Shearer, etc. And he has a son who's gay, and he had trouble coming to terms with that. And his wonderful wife did come to terms with it quite easily. And, you know, I was lucky enough to sort of be included in the conversations. And I can remember more with my brother, my older brother, who's, as I say, a twin with my older. He was very accepting of, and I never thought he would be, because he was very sort of hard old shepherd and shearer and oil rig worker, and yet he was very, very accepting. And that's another thing that I wanted to sort of come out. I think a lot more of the men that have, you know, allowed themselves to feel, are much more accepting of that alternative lifestyle.
Yeah, I think you might be being a bit hard on yourself there, because I thought your last line, how Tony smiled as he placed his fingers on David's cheek and kissed him, was, you know, when Roy has that realization, he's accepted everything, and it doesn't mean that everything's going to be kind of perfect and easy, but that fundamentally he's seen, you know, he's actually seen it. So,
that's what I wanted. Yes.
Yeah. So I think you're being a bit hard on yourself that it didn't.
Here I am. I have a tendency to do that. Again, it's the upbringing, probably. Yeah. But I'm so pleased you saw that. That's just,
yeah. It really, because something, there's something to be said with the deft hand that, you know, not, and it's what you're talking about, that you're making your reader work and stuff, that, you know, there's something to be said for that, that not everything has to be said.
Well, I believe that. I mean, other people find that irritating. I mean, I have had people say, I don't like that, but I said, I don't want to explain everything to you, because you're probably more intelligent than me anyway.
But you we're in this post-Oprah world now, where, you know, Oprah brought in the whole thing, we all have to confess everything. Everything has to be out. Mm. Everything has to be said. And, you know, there's something pinches, you know, the introvert that just wants to sit in the corner of the party, like, you know, like Joni Mitchell's character in People's Party. She's just sitting in the corner watching performances, you know, and so to me, you know, this whole
the wonderful song about I'm the one on the corner losing my religion or something.
Yeah. But, you know, to me it pinches the artist out if every, you know, one's got to be loud and standing and dancing on the table, you know, and telling everything about yourself.
Well said.
The person that just wants to observe is pinched out of that equation, really. So
I heard recently from a publisher who said that she was inundated with so many confessional works that just turned out to be a horrible embarrassment for the writer, you know. And again, and she actually mentioned that post-Oprah world where everything has to be said and laid out, and, you know, so there's a lot of things that, you know, we don't want to talk about, or, you know, we allow the reader, you know, to be the writer, allow the reader to make the story.
It must be amazing as a writer if, you know, you've given these hints, so you've given like A, C, F and G or something, and somebody comes back with these other letters in between that weren't your, you know, intention, but they've taken the little bits you've given them and come up with another answer or another slant on the situation. I mean, that must be an amazing feeling if people do that.
Well, it's an amazing feeling what you're giving me by being able to read in and see things that, in the work that I had almost given up on. I didn't think other people would see it, but people have, and people have battled with it. In fact, I've I lost a friend, and a military mate, and because he didn't like how I depicted that world, and he didn't like everything not being explained, as you say. But again, I tried to, but you know, I was just shut out. But anyway, that doesn't matter. I didn't realize it was going to be controversial, but for some people it was, and they didn't sort of like what I was saying, and that made me sad. But then I'm lucky enough to, yeah, speak to you. So thank you, Greg.
So there were 8 years between Coming Rain and A Better Place. I mean, that's longer than an elephant's gestation, really. So I'm just wondering what went on in those years.
Well, I think part of it is the economics of publishing. And I think because I write literary fiction and I'm not popular as such, I don't sell a lot. I think that, you know, that they can only publish someone like me so often. So I think, again, it's as the economic, without sort of trying to put anyone down, I think they do their very, very best. But also, I wasn't confident in having anything ready enough to show to my agent and to text, and I'd had the original work I'd shown wasn't good enough, and I'm pleased that I've got some severe critics along the way. But I mean, one of my dearest friends, who I often question myself and my work with, he said, "But if you believed completely in yourself, you'd be no good." You know, you have to question. You have to say, can it be done better? And so the beginning of that novel, for example, I wrote so many different versions, and I'd cut it right back, and I'd add pieces in, and then I just didn't like it. And sometimes it would be, you know, 20, 30, 40 times I'd rewrite it, and I'd have to wait and wait and wait. And also, you know, I used to deliver papers to try to make a living. And so I could write, and had 5 children, but it wasn't really until I was a pensioner, I'm a pensioner now, that I had the time to be able to really work. So it was fantastic, and thank you, Australia.
So how much does a new work grow out of the previous work, and what are you working on now?
I'm working on now, as I say, that was begins with that wonderful quote by Walt Whitman, "Whoever degrades another degrades me," and it's a love story of all things, and there's no guns in it, and I'm really enjoying it, and just how it's evolving. But my work, I think, is getting better. I mean, from my point of view, I like what I'm doing more and more. But all of my previous works have all sort of grown out of one another. And I'm still fascinated with the Henry Lawsons and the Banjo Pattersons, and that, you know, that wonderful poem about the colt from old regret had got away and joined the wild horses or whatever. That, you know, I think masculine men and the so-called toxic masculinity has been, well, I think there is toxic masculinity, actually, but I think men really have to regain their honour and their decency. And I'm not sure, because we've been condemned, and so many men have allowed themselves just to become imitations of what they should be, really. And I think that's my great theme in life. And I think young men have to sort of be able to tell their own stories. And they have to be honourable and decent stories. And again, that's what I'm trying to visit, and that's my great theme in life. But this next book is, I think the working title is Lily's Orchard, and it's a love story. So we'll see how it goes.
Is it historical fiction, or is it present?
Well, it's going to probably end with the 9/11 towers. You know, and the airplanes. So it's going to be relatively recent.
So you've won many awards, including being longlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize. I'm just wondering what those awards have done for you and what they've made you feel.
A certain validation, of course. And there was some money involved, which is incredibly handy. Never been very well off, but you know, it has helped. It is a validation, and I think that is about the best of it. But I think, who was it? Someone in text sent me this poem by Ezra Pound, where he said that what matters is the work, the rest is vanity, really. So, Mr. Haywood, that's who it was. Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing, because I think for me, someone like me, especially who was raised in that era of modesty, I suppose, and thinking that I was special because I'd been published and I'd won these wonderful awards, was missing the point, and that's why that poem resonates so much with me, and that's the work that matters. The rest is vanity. And if, you know, you started, for someone like me, I wouldn't be able to, I don't tell people, for example, that, you know, that I'd won those awards, etc., because I find that vain. And I can remember this wonderful time when I was back in New Zealand, and it was being recited to me in Te Reo, which is the Maori language, but the English translation is, the kumara does not speak of his own sweetness, you know, the kumara being a sweet potato. And it was being said to me over and over again, and it wasn't until sometime later that I actually began to get it, you know, just don't show off, and so modesty for me, humility has always been very important. I guess I was taught that from a very early age, you know. And in the book I talk about how humility is from the Latin humus, which means down to earth. Mm.
So just to finish up today, how do you, or do you feel that growing up on an island, how did that affect your writing and the trajectory of your life? Because I think it's a different experience to grow up on an island.
Yeah, I'm not conscious of that. I am conscious of being down the arse end of the world, as it were, and saying, hey, we're still here and we can still write. But it was Australia that really gave me the opportunity to write, coming over here, because it was so difficult where we were to be able to do that. And it was that chap, Tim Winton, the reason I came to Western Australia, I agreed to, was I'd worked over here in the mines, etc. But he was Tim Winton. I thought, well, they're pretty accepting of writers and want to be writers, so I thought it'd be okay. But I had no idea what I was doing. But yeah, wonderful Tim Winton. Yeah, as I said, my dear old mum says you'll grow out of it. Didn't I? I'm 70 this year and I haven't yet.
Oh, well, there's still time.
Good on you, Greg.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
I must say that when I read your book while I was on holiday and in Tasmania, and I started off thinking I'm not going to enjoy this, and then I kept reading and I said to my partner, this book's got me in, and I'm not sure why it's got me in. So it was pleasurable. I really enjoyed reading the book. I really enjoyed it a lot. So thank you.
But thank you. It was wonderful.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. And it's festival year, History Unbound, to be held at Parramatta Town Hall on the 1st and 2nd of November, 2025. Both in-person and online tickets are available. Please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au, register for our newsletter, and join our social media groups to be up to date. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep imagining the past. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated.